Welcome to Work of Art, the Mason Gross podcast, produced out of Rutgers University's Mason Gross School of the Arts in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We are a community of nearly 1,200 undergrad and graduate dancers, musicians, theater artists, filmmakers, and visual artists from around the globe. My name is Lori Granieri, and I'll be sitting down with some of these artists, discussing what fuels their curiosity, their passion, and their impulse to make. Christopher Cartmell is what you might call a multi-hyphenate, an award-winning playwright, actor, and director. He is also a translator of works by Molière, Voltaire, and George Sand, as well as a memoirist and a working actor. His memoir, The Nebraska Dispatches, was published in 2010 and is a one-man show. He appeared in Steven Spielberg's 2012 film Lincoln and has made his own short films, quirky, wryly funny pieces ruminating on language and human behavior. Cartmell is on faculty here at the Mason Gross School of the Arts, where he teaches, among other things, a course on global theater. Now he's set to direct the comedy The Rehearsal with Rutgers Theater Company, running March 28th through April 6th here on campus. Welcome, Christopher.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time. I know you're getting deep into...
We just had our first rehearsal last night.
Really? What was that like?
It was incredible because the set is almost complete, mm-hmm. So it allows us to work on it, and I think people will be astounded how we've recreated VJM Theater. It looks like it's always been there, but it's completely different.
Talk about the difference for all of you working on a set as opposed to in a rehearsal room.
Yeah, you rarely get the opportunity in the professional theater to work on the set for very long, because usually they're building in theater, you're stepping into another space and things like that. In this case, because the play is so centered on the text itself, that I wanted to take the obstacle of all those other things away. And because this play is about a rehearsal in a theater, it becomes important actually to understand what the space is, because I won't give anything away by saying it. There are actually box seats now in the VJM Theater, and audience will be seated on stage. So there's sort of, as they would have been in the 17th century when this was first written.
That's intense.
Yeah.
For the audience as well as...
Yeah, anybody who wants to, you have to ask. If you'd like to do this, you'll be asked if you want to do it, and then an invitation will be given you by the director of the play, fictional play, in which she will say, come to the show.
So there are a lot of layers here, the play within the play, huh?
Right.
You know, you've talked so beautifully about the process of rehearsing before. Mm-hmm. You and I have spoken about that, and I'd love for you to talk about it here. What interests you about that process? You've even... gone back and talked about the root of the word.
Right. To me, our process of creating work, and this is true across disciplines at Mason Gross, because we deal here in process, in the visual arts and design, in music, in dance, and in theater, the tradition of rehearsal has changed over time. Shakespeare's time was very different the way they approached rehearsals than we did. They weren't very long, for instance. You wouldn't have had a script the way we think of a script. You would have only received your lines. And there's a book, actually, that I obsessed over this summer called Rehearsal from Shakespeare to Sheridan, which deals with rehearsal processes over two centuries. But I also have been looking at it in a global sense, and how around the world, different languages sort of reveal a different approach to a rehearsal process that, to me, for a sense of a theater maker, but also as an educator, to allow students to understand that there may be different ways to approach each rehearsal. So in French, répétition is to repeat, but in German, probe is to investigate, or provare in Italian is to prove, sort of, but it actually has ultimately to dare.
To try.
To try.
Yeah. Provare,
and In English, I would have thought, as everybody did for many, many years, that it meant to rehear. So essentially it was connected to repeat. But in fact, that's not true. That the root of rehearsal in English comes from the word harrow, to dig up the ground. And so essentially, the root of it is to re-harrow or to re-dig up the ground to plant again. And I think that approach, because even the word harrowing has to do with that. And anybody that's been in the theater knows the challenges, which the play makes fun of, is sort of the life and death stakes of creating work that people from the audience's standpoint are just seeing as this fun entertainment, but to the creators can feel like life and death.
Yeah, that process of learning and digging and the fear that can be inherent in that.
Absolutely.
And yet it has to look so easy.
Yes. Like we were just working on a dance number last night, because in the 17th century they would have danced with these in between the pieces. And we were talking about the fact that it needed to look like everybody knew exactly what they're doing, at the same time that it has to also give the appearance that people are lost, which is an incredible balance in what we're doing.
Tell me what it's like to see the growth, the change in that process from the first day until the last performance.
I think one of the most satisfying things about being a director is knowing there's a certain point at which the cast and crew will know the show better than you. And because, again, if I'm the big picture, right now I'm interested in details, but I'm ultimately the big picture. That's my part of the collaboration, is to look at the bigger picture. But the designers and actors and the backstage, stage managers, etc., are all looking for their individual jobs. And so by the time the show goes up, their understanding of those moments is stronger than mine. And I love that. I love that sort of watching them, essentially, like the cold I'm getting over, catching the world of the play. And then once that happens, they've caught it and they move on. And hopefully it's not as painful as sometimes a cold can be.
You know, I remember hearing once, and I'd love to hear what you think of this, that essentially that filmmaking is the director's art, and that theater is the playwright is primary. Now, in this case, you've adapted this work, and I know you've translated several works, which I'd also love to talk to you about, and you're directing. Talk to me about that. Agree, disagree, but what do you see your role as the director of a play in the theater?
It changes based on the play, honestly, because that's where I think you're correct, that the play is the thing, to quote Shakespeare, or at least to quote Hamlet. The play is the thing, and so it means that I have to adapt my way of working to the way the play is asking me to work. So sometimes I can sort of sit back and let the play choose the terms, and other times I think I need to give more structure because the play is asking for it. I don't know, it's interesting because the role of the director is so new in the theater historically, really doesn't come about until the 19th century. In the era that we're talking about, which is in the play, in the rehearsal, the authors actually were the driving force behind the production. And the actors as well. There's a very funny moment in which one of the actors decides in the show that she doesn't like the edit of the play, so she decides to cut it herself for the writer. And so this job of the director seems to be changing and developing over time. And I think now in theater, it's also shifting as to what our job is. And as new positions like a dramaturg and things like that rise up, it sort of shifts the dynamic, because the theater is constantly evolving. These roles of director, dramaturg, have all been there, designer, they've all been there, but they seem to appear at different times as the work. So sometimes I'm an interpreter, sometimes I'm an audience, essentially as a director. I get to be the audience that I hope will, I want the audience to experience it. Sometimes I feel a great deal in my own work that I am a painter in the sense of creating compositions so that the story is told not just through the words, but visually. So if you turned off the sound, you would still understand the dynamic of the show. Like when I take the students to Germany and I make them see a play that they don't, in a language they don't understand, I know if it's really good work that they will understand the play.
So your understanding of theater history seems to really inform how you occupy a space as a theater artist. Talk to me a little bit about that. I imagine it gives you quite a bit of perspective.
We stand on the shoulders of giants. I mean, I was talking with the students because in the play that we're doing, the role that was traditionally played by a man, Bayes, is played by a woman. So we also have to deal with the dynamic of a woman directing the show and what is that? How does that shift? And those parts of the discussion I find fascinating. But in theater history, I was explaining to the students that actually in this era, there were incredibly strong and dynamic movers and shakers, female movers and shakers of the London theater. Thomas Betterton's wife actually ended up taking over the company. From a standpoint of a writer, Aphra Behn, whose work I've done, and Mary Picks, and one I really love, Susanna St. Liver, though her name is strange, but
it's the best.
Who was considered one of the best writers of comedy plots of her time. And I feel like history to me is alive, especially as we're trying to do classic works, and we're living in an incredible moment, I think, right now, as new voices are being allowed, or better yet, I think a better way of saying than allowed, are actually demanding to be heard within the theater. And during this time, it's important that we understand the past so that we can reassess, and this is the big question that I think we should be asking, is because we do so many classical plays, is what do these classical plays mean now? What relevance do they have to us at this moment? I've definitely struggled deeply with is what are the meanings and significance that were never intended 200 years ago, that suddenly with the casting of our company and things like that, what are the implications of it in a contemporary context? Who are the voices that can be given room, like Susanna St. Liver, because Aphra Behn is usually trotted out as sort of the only voice of female voice of the era, and that I've always found troubling because that's not true.
You're really in conversation mm-hmm. with these people.
Right.
What does it mean for you? Because I imagine some students come to this fearful, wondering how they're going to relate. How do you facilitate that conversation? How do you make it meaningful for them and for the audience?
God, that's a great question because I sometimes don't know. Sometimes it's the context that it's in. This dialogue that you're talking about with history is informing this because with audience seated on the stage, which in the 17th century we have this idea of a proscenium arch and we sat and looked at it like a painting. Well, that wasn't true then. The audience was lit as probably better than even the stage was lit. They were raucous. In France in particular, they were standing and milling around. And the show would be constantly interrupted by the people on stage who were there actually more to be seen than to see.
How did we get so staid?
Well, technology.
I'm going to say, it's sort of like we're all in church now, right?
Yeah, you know? and we take it for granted that that's the way it's always been. And I think a lot of it was theater technology, because once lighting shifted, the audience sort of passively sitting in the dark is possible. It's not possible in candlelight. It's not possible in gaslight. And also, I think it's what we use theater for, because we're in the age of the screen. So theater, in a sense, gets categorized as another extension of the screen.
You know what? Talk to me a little bit about... I'm so interested in what you've just said about the placement of the audience, right? Submerged in darkness. I've never really thought of that. And what does it mean to have the audience there in the light, in the same light as the performers?
I think a lot about it, because I think everybody hates the... or at least feels uncomfortable with the actors coming out and talking to them in the show. That often makes me cringe, which is not what we're doing in the show. But there's a movement increasingly of audience participation and discussions about how an audience is meant to participate. I mean, if you look at the word audience, it just means to hear, where a spectator is to see. And there's a term, spect actor, in which they're both watching and acting. They're moving and transforming the piece. Our audiences, I think our student audiences, are craving sort of a similar sort of engagement in the age of web tech, our screen lives. There is a sense of remove that I think people are really interested in sort of engaging actually on a different level. But we'll see. I'll be very interested, and I'm very interested in any feedback people have with regards of their feelings about this. But we're doing it in a way I think that will surprise people, because interactivity isn't me walking up to you and saying, hey, dance with me.
Right. No one's being heckled.
No one's being heckled.
No Don Rickles action here.
Or forced to do things they don't really want to do. Because to me, theater should also, engaging art should be about choice.
You know, I also want to talk to you a little bit about your own background. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's important, especially if students are listening to this, for them to know you not just as the professor, and I know you don't put yourself on high, but how you came to be who you are, a person whom I imagine they admire and they look up to. And I know, you know, you and I have talked a little bit before about your father, and I'm so interested in his influence on you, because it seems if you can share a little bit about him and about what he's meant to you as an artist and as a person, I'd love for people to hear that.
Well, thank you. I've been thinking actually a lot about him in particular. He died my last year of graduate school, and his influence was great on my first play that I wrote, his belief in me, his love of history, his understanding that if you were to do something, which was his thing, if you're going to do it with love, do it deeply, and connect to it, or don't even attempt it. And one of the quotes that I give of him that my students all take on too, he said to me that we all speak different languages, and love is an act of translation. And that's been a big influence on the way I've even taught. My mother was a teacher and a theater person. My father was a businessman. He was a grain merchant. He spoke Russian, which we know very little about sort of some of his Russian background. And he was over in, there were grain deals in the 1970s when I was a kid in Poland. And he would travel back and forth. For that, he was involved in those things.
Awesome.
And had kind of glamorous, my parents were pretty glamorous folks. I've always There's a portrait of them that I have that where they look like two Hollywood stars. But it, I think that the sense of that I've retained from him, even after just being able to be with him for 22 years, was his incredible integrity. And his desire actually to make sure that every action that he did spoke of his personal belief in what he was doing.
It's a very intentional life.
It was a very intentional life. That's a wonderful way of putting it.
How old was your father when he died?
I think 56, 57 years old.
Which, the older you get, the younger that seems.
Oh, yeah.
I understand.
Yes.
So he was not the kind of guy saying, do something solid, son, you know, get a desk job. What was his...
No, he had his fears about it. I mean, I think every theater artist has had this conversation with their parents, this sort of theatrical or artistic coming out in which you say, I want to be an artist. And I remember, particularly with him, there was a conversation in which I was getting ready to head over to Scotland and to the Royal Scottish Academy. And my father then realized at that point that I was serious about this, that I knew what I was going to do. And the talk with me was such a great gift as a parent, because it was this thing where he said, look, what I do is an art form, and this is how I believe it's an art form. And I see that that's the way you're going to approach your work. And therefore, I know you're going to be safe. I know you're going to do this the way you want to do it. And that was an incredible thing to have, because I never would have thought to ask for that. And the fact that he gave that gift to me was important.
I can imagine that it must have sustained you.
Oh, yeah.
Some pretty dark moments.
And still does, because I think that you know, and one of the things he didn't say to me, but I think I feel his voice in, is this belief that the artist in you, per our conversation about the artist, will wait a second, let me say this differently. The careerist in you will get you a job. But the artist will get you a career. And that our careers will never look like anybody else's. They'll always be idiosyncratic, particularly in the arts, where we're constantly adapting. We have to both to changing times, but also to changing circumstances. And I think, for me, if I hadn't... Honestly, that moment with him and the conversation, I can see the room that we were in, and I can see his face as he spoke to me and sort of essentially gave his blessing to me doing what I'm doing, really has had a great deal of significance about where I am now and even the choices I make now.
And, you know, that makes me think, going back to your students, so not every person you're teaching will be on the stage or backstage or involved in the arts at all. But that doesn't mean this isn't useful. So talk to me about what you see as an artistic approach to work.
Wow.
Outside of...
What a great question. Because honestly, I do think that the work that we do here in the arts has significance no matter where you go. Not just in simple things like the poise you have to have a conversation with people, which people always talk about, actors. Acting training gives you a sense of how to speak in front of a group of people. But it also has to do with a sensibility, doesn't it? That you can move through the world with a consciousness, a sensitivity. I mean, one of the other words that I talk about in the class in global theater is a word that we take for granted at this point, that we act as though has actually always been there, is the word empathy. It actually comes from a term. It was made up in the 20th century. It didn't exist until the 20th century. And it came from a term, a German term, Einfühlung, a feeling. That a couple of philosophers talked about, that when we see art, we get Einfühlung, a feeling. And that feeling is ultimately empathy, that we begin to step into someone else's shoes, feel how they feel. And particularly in our day and age, I think that need to be able to take that leap into the heart and soul of another person is wanting and desperately needful. And I feel, no matter what form and discipline of the arts you are, whether the performing arts or the visual arts, plastic arts even, you are connected to Einfühlung. You live in the feeling. You create the feeling. You encourage it. And that cannot but help you in whatever you do.
Well, Christopher, thank you so much. See Christopher Cartmell's work as he directs the rehearsal with Rutgers Theatre Company, running March 28th through April 6th here on campus. Thank you so much.
Thank you.